America for two papers dealing with Latin American music. Theodore S. Beardsley, Jr. is director of the Hispanic Society of America. He has taught at Rider College, Southern Illinois University, University of Wisconsin, NYU, Columbia, and Adelphi University. He has served as the chairman of the Museums Council of New York City, has been a special consultant on Hispanic bibliography at the Library of Congress, and has narrated Spanish language tour tapes for the National Gallery, the Metropolitan, Smithsonian, and other museums. He has also produced a series of programs on Caribbean popular music for WBGO-FM. I'm pleased to introduce Mr. Beardsley. Whose topic will be Enrique Madriguera, Pseudonyms and Anonymous Collaborations.
How did you find all that out? I've been looking over my shoulder.
Enrique Ramon Madriguera y Rodón was born in Barcelona in 1902. He began violin and piano lessons before school age, and then with his older sister Paquita, studied at the Academy of Music, founded and run by the famous composer Enrique Granados. Paquita, later to become Mrs. Andrés Segovia, was Granados' favorite, his star pupil. Little brother Enrique, although no slouch at the piano, quickly emerged as a violin prodigy. Before the age of 10, he wrote his first musical composition, signing his name as Nodor, his mother's maiden name, Rodón, spelled backwards. He would use this, his first documented pseudonym, in sporadic fashion all the way into the 1930s. Paquita's career flourished after a series of brilliant concerts in Barcelona, and fresh from a triumphant debut at Albert Hall in London at the age of 15, she was brought, together with her mother and Enrique, by the Aeolian Company to the United States for a series of concerts, from New York to Chicago to San Francisco and lots of other places. Over a year later, in March of 1917, at a concert at Aeolian Hall, she was, quote, assisted by Enrique Madriguera, violinist. This was Enrique's New York debut. At the end of that year, Paquita, with her mother, departed on a South American tour. Enrique, soon to be 16, was finally allowed to remain in New York in order to study with the celebrated Russian violinist Leopold Auer, who was about to arrive here from Russia. It was at this time, probably in order to earn spending money, that Madriguera began to play with dance bands in and around New York City, possibly using the pseudonym Ed Violinsky. Yes. In any event, as an aspiring concert violinist, he would, for over 10 years, only use the name Madriguera in connection with classical music. When in New York, the Madriguera family stayed at the home of their old friend, Rosa Culmel Venin, formerly a voice coach at the Granados Academy. Mrs. Nin's young daughter, to become the well-known writer Anaïs Nin, developed a strong crush on Enrique, 2 years older than she, and fortunately for us, she devotes considerable space in her now-published diary, Linat, to Enrique, his activities, his whereabouts, his comings and goings, even to the restroom sometimes, from 1919 to 1922. During this time, she will be allowed to accompany Enrique on dance band gigs, provided that her younger brother, subsequently the prominent composer and musicologist Joaquín Nin Culmel, provided that he goes along as chaperone and table companion while Enrique is on the bandstand. By this time, he has Tin Pan Alley connections. Between June of 1918 and the spring of 1919, he composes for several music publishing companies half a dozen hack songs, which he copyrights as by Ray Lawrence, his second documented pseudonym. One of his collaborators in this early venture is bandleader Arthur Lang. Following an established pattern of intermittent resurrections of old pseudonyms, he will use the name Ray Lawrence for official copyright again in 1924 and finally in 1947. In 1919, saxophonist Bert Rolton left Art Hickman's orchestra to form a band in Havana. Various circumstances suggest that Madrigera was involved in this venture. Anais tells us that he's out of the country for almost 6 months. She can hardly stand that. In late 1919, Enrique is back in New York, and a session of Cuban melodies is recorded in New York, ascribed by Rust to Coleman's Castle Orchestra. For the moment, we'll put that one on the back burner. At the end of 1920, Enrique ceases his studies with Leopold Auer, switching to Juan Manén, a violinist from Barcelona, then in New York for an extended period. Subsequently, he will have to follow Manén around the world, from New York to London to Paris to Barcelona. Paquita has now married, left the concert stage, and Enrique's father has entered a tuberculosis sanitarium in Spain. Suddenly, Enrique has considerable financial responsibilities for his parents and for his two younger sisters. In the earlier 1920s, he appears to pay for his Atlantic crossings by performing on shipboard for the major Spanish line Compañía Transatlántica out of Barcelona, with major ports in Havana and New York. Family friends own a controlling interest in this company. In the earlier 1920s, Enrique appears to have played intermittently with a London dance band. Incidentally, Ralton's Havana group is at the Savoy Hotel by mid-1922, as well as in Paris with the Argentinian tango band Bianco Bachicha. In early 1923, Anais Nin goes to Havana to be married, but not to Enrique. Nonetheless, she finds him there when she arrives. He is performing somewhere, but also making arrangements with Gonzalo Roig, founder of the new Havana Symphony, for a series of classical concerts that will feature Juan Manin, Pablo Casals, and young Madrigera. These are highly successful, but the major economic result for Enrique is that he becomes director of his own dance band at the posh Havana Casino, now for the first time using his own name. Not in the United States, however. In Tampa, Florida, in late 1922, probably in town from Havana without a visa, he accompanies a well-known Spanish baritone in concert. He is second on the bill, and he uses the name René Moreno. Since the days of Paquita's triumphs in New York and through his now deceased mentor, Granados, Madrigera has two close, valuable connections in the New York music world: the Aeolian Company, and Nathaniel Shilkret, director of popular recording at Victor. As early as 1921, a shadowy, apparently non-existent violinist named Max Dolan suddenly emerges as an orchestra director, studio band, at Victor, Shilkret also performing on some of these takes. Confined at first to only a few sessions, the music is exclusively Cuban danzones, tangos, and Latin waltzes. But upon Madrigera's return to New York with a new batch of sheet music in hand, the Dolan sessions proliferate, and as well, Shilkret's International Novelty Orchestra suddenly begins to record a number of tangos and danzones, including Gonzalo Roig's composition, Quiereme Mucho, Yours in English, which is to become an American staple. By June of 1924, the Art Hickman Band has left New York and is now recording at the Victor Studio at Oakland, California. So is Max Dolan's Spanish-Cuban Orchestra. The Hickman unit ceases to record at Oakland in 1925. So does Max Dolan, who is never heard from again until, on one occasion, he directs a concert in Hollywood in the 1940s while Madrigera is there under exclusive contract to Columbia Pictures. While Dolan has bloomed at Victor, another group has emerged at Vocalion called the Castilians. This is patently a Madrigera group, as we shall see, and it even records an unpublished composition that was written for Paquita. Ed Violinsky seems to have died with the birth of Max Dolan, and now another violinist springs full-blown at Victor Records, Joe Raymond, who also plays tangos and danzones. A notable frustration occurs in 1925 with the acquisition of the Vocalion label by Brunswick Records. The cloudy association between the orchestra of Louis Katzman, supposedly the studio director, and that of Madrigera's Castilians becomes hopelessly entangled. Joe Raymond disappears from sight, as does the International Novelty Orchestra, built billed henceforth as Nat Shilkret's orchestra. At some point soon after 1925, Madriguera becomes director of the Brunswick House Orchestra, clinging for a time to the name Castilians for Latin Music, and then switching to a new pseudonym, documented, the Alonzo Orchestra. By late 1927, the Alonzo Orchestra is advertised as, quote, under the direction of Enrique Madriguera, and is available for live engagements, as well as recordings on Brunswick Records, Madriguera now functioning as his own booking agent. By this time, he is also using simultaneously the names Anglo-Persians, Floridians, Argentines on Brunswick, and Ambassadors on Vocalion, usage depending on the type of music that he's recording, be it foxtrots, Cuban danzones, or Argentinian tangos. These names remain in motion until 1933. In late 1928, with much fanfare, Enrique Madriguera, as such, is appointed the director of Latin American recording for Columbia Records. For the next 4 years, he produces an astonishing number of recordings, a veritable anthology of Latin music from Mexico to Argentina, using a number of Latin singing stars, a practice that he had begun at Brunswick. Although the name Madriguera is now prominent on those Green X labels, the product is primarily for export, not for sale within the United States. During this period, Madriguera also plays violin on recordings at Victor that are ascribed to Don Aspiazu, the Havana Novelty Orchestra, Shilkret again, and various others. The Aspiazu group was responsible for introducing to American audiences such hits as The Peanut Vendor and Green Eyes composed by Madriguera's pianist, Nilo Menendez. And curiously enough, the first edition of the sheet music for Green Eyes attributes its introduction to Madriguera, complete with his photograph, and citing the Victor recording with its number. The label of that recording, however, attributes the take to Don Aspiazu and his Havana Casino Orchestra. At this point, Columbia issues Madriguera's recording of Si Bonet and Adios by Enrique Madriguera and his Havana Casino Orchestra. For some 5 years, first at Columbia and finally at Victor, a new American-styled orchestra is in motion. Enrique Madriguera and his Hotel Biltmore Orchestra, subsequently Hotel Whalen Orchestra. This orchestra plays sweet society music featuring the voices of Richard Berry, Tony Sacco, Adelaide Moffat, and Helen Dell. The music is completely American, with only an occasional Latin piece like Carioca or Arcas in the Moonlight from Astaire Rogers movies. It appears that, for the moment, Madriguera has pretty much given up the ghost in terms of a classical career and is at last willing to use his own name in public associated with popular music. Not so, however, for Latin music. During this same period, he will take part of his orchestra to play tangos and rumbas at Monte Carlo for the summer season, recording for Old Crown Records as the San Remo Orchestra or the Civilians, for Brunswick as the Argentinians or the Zito Orchestra, Horacio Zito is his bandoneon player, and for Decca as the Castilians or as the Jose Ramos Tango Orchestra. He also apparently takes the band to London on occasion. Recordings of Strauss waltzes by Alonzo crop up on Rec's label in 1933. Various factors suggest that Madriguera was involved in the music for several of the films of Argentina's singing star Carlos Gardel. Filmed near Paris in the fall of 1932, Madriguera was there, Espérame contains Caribbean music as well as tangos, composition and direction ascribed to Don Aspiazu. Gardel's last two films, made on Long Island in early 1935, are under the musical direction of Terig Tucci, perhaps a pseudonym for Horacio Zito, but in any event involved in the recordings attributed to Antobal and to the Castilians. Among the number of good, or at least interesting, reasons that Madriguera had for using pseudonyms, perhaps the strongest is his increasing refusal to cooperate with the powers that be in the popular music business. For reasons of ethics and for reasons of traditional Catalan thrift, he steadfastly refused to have an agent or to join ASCAP. Increasingly, he flew in the face of unions, and increasingly, he neglected to copyright or to publish his own compositions. That way, only he could play them. As he became more successful commercially, this admirable stance came to be dangerous. In the spring of 1933, at Monte Carlo, he gave his last known classical recital. That summer, his rumba band played the casino, but in the fall, two of his fingers were broken and mutilated in an altercation. The official press version is that he was coming to the defense of two young American girls in distress. Family tradition has it otherwise. He was refusing, quote, to pay off to the music czars, unquote. In any event, Madriguera will soon fall partially from sight. After a session for Victor in the fall of 1935, the Madriguera Orchestra will not record again as such until the end of the summer of 1939. With great press fanfare, Madriguera signs an exclusive NBC contract late in 1935. He finishes up an engagement at the Morrison Hotel in Chicago, followed by a brief appearance in Cincinnati in early 1936, and ostensibly disappears from live performance. He is heard weekly on the radio and is seen in several Warner Brothers short films. But in late 1933, just after the mishap at Monte Carlo, a new American orchestra is put into motion on Vocalion Records and fronted by a nebulous pianist called Henry King. One musician's widow affirms that this is a Madriguera organization. Mercedes Madriguera, Enrique's sister, affirms that he is Henry King. The vocalist called Joe Sudi, supposedly a pseudonym for Tony Sacco, Madriguera's longtime vocalist. So far, I've not been able to get hard evidence for this. During the period of Madriguera's brownout, the late 1930s, Latin American music thrives in the United States under the batons of Cugat and Carlos Molina. Cugat is a fixture at Victor, with Molina at Columbia and then at Decca. Some of the takes attributed to Antobal, a maraca player, possibly the brother of Don Aspiazu, if not Aspiazu himself, we aren't sure who he is, at Brunswick in 1936 and 1937 include Madriguera and his violin, as do the tangos recorded at Decca in 1938 ascribed to Pancho. Another early connection of Madriguera's was with the radio group known as the A&P Gypsies, directed by another nebulous person called Harry Horlick. Some rather curious crossovers occur here. The Gypsies leave the airways in 1936 when Madriguera, as Madriguera, on the radio begins. A rather odd, perhaps tongue-in-cheek press article describes a party held by the musicians to celebrate their radio demise, awake as it were, mentioning in passing that Horlick was Louis Katzman's violinist. No, Madriguera was. And that one of the gypsy specialties was the rumba. No, it was not. In any event, both Horlick and Madriguera seemed to come to life again on Decca in the late 1930s. Madriguera does two albums of congas and rumbas under the name Eddie LeBaron. Remember Henry King, Eddie LeBaron. And in addition to waltzes for modern dancing, that was Madriguera's specialty at Columbia a few years earlier, Horlick produces an album of classical Spanish violin pieces of Albéniz, another of compositions by Cuba's Ernesto Lecuona, and another of Spanish light classical melodies, which includes a piece composed for Paquita Madriguera. While the relief band of Eddie LeBaron plays Latin at the Rainbow Room, the feature attraction is the gypsy violin of Emery Deutsch, whose brief recording career only occurs on labels where Madriguera is performing at the same time. Somewhere in the 1930s, Madriguera seems to have tied up with an old acquaintance, a man named Eli Oberstein of Victor Records. For Varsity Records, Madriguera brings Eddie LeBaron back out again. One particularly amusing label ascribes the composition to LeBaron, orchestra to LeBaron, vocal in Spanish to LeBaron, that vocal actually performed by Madriguera's vocalist, Adolfo Utrera, the man who wrote the Spanish lyrics for Green Eyes. By this time, the Madriguera Orchestra is again playing in public and at last openly and unashamedly given to Latin music, both on records and at such places as La Conga nightclub in New York. At this time, a man named Jose Morand appears at Decca, providing backup for a plethora of Latin stars, exactly in the fashion that Madriguera had done on Green Label Columbia in the early 30s. Morand will come back again. Toward the end of a Columbia contract in 1940, and before the term for another one at Victor, Madriguera crops up on Bluebird Label, usually in disguise. For the only time in his career, the name of the Madriguera Orchestra appears in smaller letters on the label and under the larger name of another performer. This is an early 1940 Bluebird issue, the other performer, Patricia Gilmore, having recently become Mrs. Madriguera. After that, her name gets little again. On several other takes, Madriguera appears as simply Orchestra for the Cuban soprano Graciela Párraga. For Vincent Lopez, he puts together an exceptional percussion group, which includes Tito Puente and his Madriguera's own new vocalist, Tito Rodriguez, providing himself several violin segments. The studio log identifies the violinist on these takes as Sidney Swilling, Mr. Madriguera's little joke at his own fondness for Hetty Brew. In early 1941, his Victor contract goes into effect, and until the record ban of 1942, Madriguera seems not to play the pseudonym game very much, other than providing anonymous backup for various Latin stars like Tito Guisar on Victor label. But with the Petrillo ban, the simplicity of the Madriguera monopoly of pseudonyms finally gives way to complications. At least some of the issues of Continental Records, apparently another Oberstein enterprise, seem to have been recorded during the ban. Most of Madriguera's early takes for Crown as the San Remo Orchestra are now reissued on Varsity, ascribed either to the Lopez or the Rodriguez Orchestra. These takes surface again on Continental and Montgomery Ward with those same attributions, but interspersed now with new Madriguera takes attributed to the South American Gauchos, the Tango Serenaders, or Sulla's Rumba Band. A number of the arrangements are ascribed to Sulla Levitch, apparently a close relative of Harry Horlick and Sidney Swilling. Jose Morand records a gaggle of compositions, including items by Granados and other Spanish composers, but attributed to Morand himself, things by Granados, along with some musical baiting of Xavier Cugat, Mr. Madriguera's Bete Noire. While the band rages on, Madriguera also does some film work and arranging, including the Latin numbers with Hoagy Carmichael for the Bogart Bacall film, To Have and Have Not, where he continuously plays hide-and-seek with the camera, his violin, forehead, and elbow conspicuous in the shadow of Carmichael's piano. Decca is the first to buy off Mr. Petrillo, and soon thereafter, the Latin numbers and the violin in the new orchestra of Carmen Cavallero, Madriguera's former pianist, sound very much like the maestro himself. When the ban ends, Madriguera becomes the king of Latin music, now on the little labels. Almost all of the little labels. Hit, Majestic, Sonora, Varsity, National, Cosmo, Vogue, on and on. As Madriguera, that is. The Henry King Band converted overnight a year before the ban. They're now a rumba orchestra. They do an album for Black and White and disappear. One of the band's singers, Bobby Ramos, shows up in tow with a Latin orchestra on Aladdin label that features a very familiar-sounding violin. Jose Morand is everywhere, Apollo, Musicraft, Goody, Gotham, Coral, and even briefly at Victor, where he records a woeful number ascribed to Cugat that Xavier never wrote. Madriguera revives the old Emil Coleman collaboration, first on Deluxe and then on Decca, with Mr. Coleman suddenly a consummate expert with such esoteric forms as the Colombian bambuco or the Venezuelan pasillo. In all of this, I have spared you, believe it or not, quite a number of other possible and probable Madriguera pseudonyms and collaborations with the likes of Eddie Duchin, Stan Kenton, and perhaps even Glenn Miller. Among the many reasons for the use of so many names and subterfuges is indeed the continuing problem of Mr. Cugat, which comes to an ignominious head in 1951 in Montevideo, Uruguay, where the Madriguera Orchestra was appearing as the official orchestra for Carnival. Cugat arranged to get himself an appearance at a local hotel, and then discreetly, he thought, went to Madriguera's longtime guitarist, Tony Sacco, offering him double his salary to leave the Madriguera Orchestra in the middle of this engagement, and furthermore, a bounty for all the other orchestra members who would do likewise. The loyal friend, Mr. Sacco, went straight to Mr. Madriguera with this offer. Mr. Madriguera called a press conference. Mr. Cugat left town. In the 1950s, Madriguera went into semi-retirement with his growing family to open a posh Spanish restaurant in Connecticut, where he and Mrs. Madriguera were content to perform on the weekends with a small orchestra. Content as far as live public is concerned. Now the pseudonyms go out of bounds. The Madriguera retirement to the country is only partial. By this time, our man has created three different music companies, the bigger Magnet Music, with a premise in Manhattan. He embarks on a new enterprise, more complicated than he probably envisioned. Always ready to circumvent the middleman, Madriguera uses pickup musicians to produce rehearsal tapes for record albums. He then offers the tapes as samples to the major record companies with a view and a hope of recording these selections in glorious sound after additional precision rehearsal. Surprise! The quality of the rehearsal tapes is more than adequate for the front office. They will take them now as finished copy. No reason to spend any more money in additional studio time and more musicians' fees. After many a disappointment, Madriguera cedes. He sells the tapes, but not the Madriguera name. Back to the pseudonyms, the old, Terry Tucci, the Castilians, as well as some more new ones, Don Amore, Don Enrico, Manuel, Alfredo. On at least one occasion, he appears to have sold the same tape to two different companies, so that the same tangos appear on Coronet label as by the Nick Arnold Orchestra and on Spanorama as Jose Grande. Tapes on the lesser labels probably constitute rejections by the major labels, or just as likely, performances considered exceptionally substandard by Madriguera himself. All the while, his relationship with Oberstein seems to continue in force, and the successive labels Varsity, Royale, Halo, Gramophone, Remington, Plymouth, Allegro, and Design relentlessly reprint earlier Madriguera sessions, often identifying the maestro with his real name. Some of these include early Madriguera takes that were never released in their own time, as well as some new tangos by Emil Coleman, the one Latin dance he hadn't tried yet. With all of this, Madriguera is finally dashed against the rocks. Years of refusing to play the conventional game of musical monopoly bring on more retribution. RCA manages to lose and destroy two of the best series of sessions that he ever produced, an album of violin solos of the music of Ernesto Lecuona, and an anthology of his own compositions. Mercifully, he retained a partial set of rejected tapes. Let's let Mr. Madriguera have the floor now in his understated way. Villa-Lobos. Okay. Shortly after this debacle, Madriguera, apparently along with Mr. Oberstein, goes into bankruptcy. The posh Connecticut operation is sold. Mr. Madriguera, however, leaves no one except himself and his family with any financial loss. He is now over 60. With this disaster, he seems to bury all of the pseudonyms. Henceforth, he performs only and exclusively, as far as we know, as Enrique Madriguera. He composes, produces, and performs a new semi-classical ballet, The Follies of Spain, performed in Washington, D.C., on television as well, with some excerpts for Ed Sullivan. He then takes the ballet to Spain. At the same time, he starts rehearsals on a musical comedy, lyrics and music by Madriguera. In Barcelona, he assembles a 53-piece symphony orchestra with soprano Maria Dolores Molina and tenor Luis Olivares to record his latest compositions, including pieces from The Follies and from the musical that is in progress. The disc is also released in the United States on Era label. Shortly thereafter, he suffers a massive stroke. His son brings him home to Connecticut, where he dies at the age of 72. I present myself to you today somewhat under false pretenses, not under a pseudonym, however. I am only today's spokesman for a whole team of us who are endeavoring to make some sense of this frustrating puzzle. His family in Connecticut and in Barcelona, Mr. John Mucci of Connecticut Television, and a plethora of cooperative friends, Andres Segovia, Alicia de la Rocha, Carmen Cavallero, Mrs. Tony Sacco, and many, many others. I'm here today not so much to give you information as to beg you for it. I'm here in the hope that some of you may have some information, maybe not any more names, but chunks or slivers. We need everything we can lay our hands on. This fascinating character, a consummate musician, insisted on playing the musical game his own way. Composer, arranger, bandleader, violinist, pianist, booking agent, studio director, orchestra manager, music publisher, recording executive, restaurateur, producer, and outrageous inventor of pseudonyms. He danced to a wide array of tunes, jazz and swing, waltz, Latin of all stripes, classical, and even gypsy violin. His major legacy to the development of American music is what John Storm Roberts calls the Latin tinge. Other imitators lay claim to that distinction, but for over 50 years, quietly and under cover of far too many other names, Madriguera gave American music a new and permanent modality. It's unlikely that we will ever put together all of his names and all of his contributions, but the history of American music is patently incomplete without taking into account his participation from before 1920 until after 1970. Any help that you can give us will be enormously appreciated. Thank you.